Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week is the first of a three-part series on the Star Wars prequel trilogy, which I thought I would do leading up to the release of Star Wars The Force Awakens on December the 18th, I believe. So I'm going to do Phantom Menace this week. Next week will be Attack of the Clones, and Revenge of the Sith will follow, leading us all up to the big moment on December 18th. Before I get started, I want to do a little bit of feedback. I wanted to say thanks to a listener named Pascal, who made a comment on the scifionscreen.com website about Alien 3. He said, hey, you should really watch the assembly cut. I think it makes for a much better movie overall. For example, they show us a bit more about the religious stuff. Still leaves Newt and Hicks dead, though, and that just sucks, Pascal. And then he sent me a link to a site called www.movie-censorship.com and the Alien 3 site, which has all kinds of neat stuff comparing certain things that were cut and, you know, all kinds of information about the movie. So thanks a lot, Pascal. I will definitely check that out for sure. A little bit of a background about episode 1. By the time of Return of the Jedi was completed, Lucas had said he was burnt out and was going to take a break from the series. So Jedi was released in 83. Lucas lost much of his fortune in a divorce settlement in 1987, and he kind of unofficially canceled the sequel trilogy at that point. He was kind of burnt out. I guess his life had taken an interesting turn, you know, and he was pretty much done with the trilogy. But because he had done all this work, you know, in order to develop the characters for Empire and Jedi, he had to kind of go back and, you know, and do this story of the family and Anakin Skywalker and so on and so forth. He still kind of nibbled away at it. And then in the 90s, Star Wars kind of expanded universe was born. Not really born, but really took off when Timothy Zahn released the first of a trilogy in hardcover, which I remember buying the first week it was out, Heir to the Empire. Which is what's called his Thrawn trilogy, which is a terrific series of books, which I believe Lucas read. But it purports to continue the story after Jedi and, you know, all these wonderful characters. And Dark Horse at that point also had comics going, so the Star Wars comics were fairly popular as well. So Lucas kind of got a sense that there's still an audience out there, especially since the sales of Heir to the Empire were ridiculous. He started taking a crack at the prequel trilogy. He also was seeing all these special effects, Jurassic Park, The Abyss, that effects were really coming up more and more, and he could do so many things digitally, which, you know, he always says he wanted to do with the original trilogy, but the technology hadn't caught up with his ideas yet. In 1994, he started writing the new trilogy. So a brief little anecdote about this. Anakin was first written as a 12-year-old, but Lucas reduced his age to 9 because he felt the lower age would fit better with the plot point of Anakin being affected by his mother's separation from him. The working title for at that point was Star Wars The Beginning, and then of course he revealed The Phantom Menace as the title, a reference to Palpatine, who was behind the scenes pulling strings. We start off with, right away we start off with a problem, basically. So we get this crawl in the beginning. We hear something about the taxation of trade routes to outlying star systems is in dispute. Okay, this trade federation is blockading the world of Naboo. And for the life of me, not until researching stuff for this podcast, I never had a clue as to what the hell this meant, what it had to do with the story at all. My main problem with this is that what we are never told is, okay, we can intuit from the film that Sidious is basically manipulating the Trade Federation into blockading and invading Naboo. I get that much. Sidious wants them to do what they're doing simply because it will create the necessary events which will allow him to manipulate Amidala and the Senate, Valorum and all these people into the no-confidence vote, in which he feels at this point that he has enough votes and sympathies in the Senate to ascend to Supreme Chancellor. I get that much, right? But what's never told, what's in it for the Trade Federation? Why do they care about taxation and trade routes? And what Lucas does, he decides, I'll just tell the people that this is a dispute and that they're invading and killing people. You know, I won't tell them why. It'll be enough and I can get my story off the ground, right? When it comes to motivations, this Trade Federation, what does a Trade Federation want? They want to make money. They want to tax goods. You know, they want to make as much money as they can. They're invading and then annihilating these species. We're told throughout many points throughout the movie that, you know, the people are dying. How many times does that line come up in this movie? People are dying. Why the Trade Federation is murdering people, which we don't see, and we don't really get a sense that this is really happening, on Naboo. Why? For what? All it's going to do is, you know, it's going to get out that the Trade Federation is engaged in warfare and slaughter. And then the Gungans come out and they're battling the Gungans. Like, why? What is in it for them? And I never could understand it. It always bothered me because at the end of the movie, it's all about, you know, we've got to capture the Viceroy. It's like, why would they go through all this? Why would they risk all this for no motivation? And I feel like it's, you know, not this is not Lawrence of Arabia, okay? But look, it matters. Because in the back of my mind, watching this movie, I think subliminally I come up against the lack of motivation over and over again. And I'm sort of like, oh, it doesn't matter. Oh, and Lucas is kind of telling me in one way or another, doesn't matter. Doesn't really matter. Focus on this lightsaber. Look, here's a funny character jumping up and down. Look at him. Isn't that great? You know, don't trouble your head about all this other stuff. So I can't take the movie that seriously because he's not either. So I went online and did some research. There have been some expanded universe books that have been written about the period leading up to Phantom Menace, which I have not read, but one is called Darth Plagueis, and I think it was when Sidious was Plagueis's apprentice, and when he tells a story in Sith, it's actually, you know, canon story that he killed Plagueis. But Plagueis and he were manipulating events in the galaxy leading up to this, and so I came across a Reddit user. He's really, really fantastic. He got some sense into it. So I'm going to quote this paragraph that he wrote because it makes sense. So, quote, "The Trade Federation began militarizing to fend off pirates. Sidious began to influence Newt Gunray into militarizing further." Okay, so far so good. "Going so far as to create a droid army. The Trade Federation was protesting the taxation of the Free Trade Zone. The Free Trade Zone was a collection of mid and outer rim planets that business could conduct business without being taxed by the Republic. The Republic changed course and wanted to then start taxing those areas. So the Trade Federation is up in arms. They create a blockade on Naboo so nothing can get to the planet. The treaty they wanted signed," which I didn't know this either, "was the free trade petition that would support turning the free trade zones back into tax-free areas." So Palpatine did not want the treaty signed. He wanted Naboo put under Trade Federation control to thus start to weaken the Republic's grip on some of these outer systems. And giving the Trade Federation, I guess, more resources, they will eventually mutate into the sort of separatist, one of the main arms. I think the Banking Clan, the Trade Federation, they're all part of the separatist movement, which was something, I guess, in the book Darth Plagueis, was something that Palpatine and Plagueis were trying to set up because they had this long-term plan about, you know, splitting the galaxy in civil war. So anyway, end quote, there you have it. It makes sense. I would assume the people writing the Star Wars books had maybe access to some materials that Lucas may have sketched. They may be making this up whole cloth, but there's one possible scenario for this whole thing. And, you know, obviously, those books are now called Legacy, which means they're not full canon anymore. Well, they never really were. It was expanded universe to begin with, although I believe some of them were canon, some of them were not. So anyway, you decide. There's more than I thought was written about this. some of the Star Wars. Wikipedia doesn't really cover it very much, but go to the Star Wars subreddit on Reddit and type in Trade Federation treaty or whatever, and you know, it'll come up. So anyway, I thought it was very interesting. Back to the film. So now we're back to our exquisite exterior visuals that George so excels in. Wonderfully wide screen shot of this Chancellor Valorum's ambassadorial, you know, ship, which is the first ship that we see. You know, it's not the Star Destroyer, right? But still looks beautiful. When they board the Trade Federation main ship, we get a look at these droid soldiers for the first time. We're visually checking 3PO already. There's a protocol droid named TC-14, which greets our Jedi. Now we've got the two Jedi. So we've got the wonderful Liam Neeson playing Qui-Gon Jinn, who to me is one of the two actors in this entire film who can actually make George's language. It's amazing what Neeson is. Neeson needs to be like a verb. Something is Neesonified or Neesonian or something where, you know, an actor is able to take the most ludicrous and absurd dialogue and make it sound authentic. And Liam Neeson somehow can do that. And we also see the other actor in this film who is of Neeson's caliber, Ian McDiarmid, playing Lord Darth Sidious, and we see him briefly on a hologram talking to the Trade Federation guys. I guess Newt Gunray and his sidekick. You know, we start out with this the Jedi in action, which I think it's really cool. Their ship is destroyed, which is kind of weird. They blow up the ship rather than just quarantine it inside the main control ship, but it's very dramatic. And then they try to gas them to death. And there's this wonderful scene when the protocol droid walks out of the conference room they've been waiting in, and all these droids are waiting outside with guns drawn, and there's only fog. And all of a sudden, you see two lightsabers, green and blue, light up inside the fog. It's very dramatic. I really like it. They're in action, you know, taking out all the droids. I immediately thought, I didn't realize, but we're in the prime, or at least the decline, but in the main Jedi era. You know, it's not Ben Kenobi anymore, and Luke, like these are fully trained Jedi, and they have this wonderfully acrobatic fighting style, and they're jumping all over the place, and it's really exciting to watch. Someone, one of the, I think, Expanded Universe authors came up with the fighting styles of all the Jedi, and one of them is called Ataro, and Ataro is developed to counter energy weapons, and I think very much Obi-Wan at this point is an Ataro practitioner. I'm not sure. Maybe Qui-Gon as well. But it's a very active style, which just has them jumping around and deflecting bolts into droids, and it's really wonderful. And then there's this also great sequence where we start, you know, here we are. We haven't seen any Star Wars in years, and all of a sudden these two Jedi are going crazy. And then also, Qui-Gon starts to cut through the door leading to the main control room where sort of Nuke Gunray is. So they want to take control of the ship. And we see it's a beautiful effect of him, you know, cutting through this massive steel door and really wonderful. And then yet another bit of novelty, you know, these droid Dekars, as Newt Gunray calls them, but they're destroyers, master destroyers, these droids who roll like balls and then immediately kind of stop where they want to go and deploy. And they're basically droids with repeating laser weapons and shields. The two Jedi are at a standoff, and they have to kind of bail and escape. But very cool, very action-oriented setup, you know, really, really cool. So now, you know, they sneak on to some transports, and they head down to Naboo. We get the initial shots of Naboo, which look beautiful. Just, I mean, the art direction in this film is really wonderful. Naboo's sort of this weird, like, gigantic classicism. It's almost like if you walk through, you know, Greek temples, but you were only like a third of the size. That's kind of Naboo. Like, it's just very overawe, but it's beautifully rendered. I mean, it looks like it's a beautiful, I think, Naboo City. I'm not sure if that's the name of it, but really beautiful. And then we see Princess Amidala, who is called the Trade Federation. And we see these wonderful costumes. Her costumes in this film are really beautiful, too. They're modeled often on Japanese sort of, you know, kimonos and you know, female Japanese garb of like maybe the, you know, the 1600s, 1700s, maybe earlier. I'm not really sure. But they're really beautiful, very detailed. You can really tell that these things really took, you know, a long time over, you know, the costume design here. Really beautiful. And then we're given a nice long landing sequence. So, you know, we hear the John Williams score, which is so beautiful in this film. The trumpets and the brass are there. The droid army is landing, and the ships are huge, you know, really fantastic. And then our two Jedi are fleeing the newly landed droid army, and they bump into Jar Jar Binks. So, look, I have two commentaries around Jar Jar. I believe he was the very first CGI character ever done on the screen. So technically, it's a landmark moment for film because Jar Jar leads to Sméagol, Gollum of Lord of the Rings. It's a direct line through, you know, Jackson and their team building on what George and ILM had done here with Jar Jar. So it's definitely a bit dated as you watch it, but you have to remember this is the very first time that we're getting, you know, like a fully computer-generated image of a character, and it's a full-on character dealing with our two Jedi. So I will say that. The other side of this, as we all know, is that Jar Jar is an idiotic, stupid character for, you know, subhuman beings, or for very, very young children, which I think George had at the time. So in George's mind, these films kind of grow up with his child, right? Because the next film is a bit of an adolescent. And then Return of the Jedi, we have a young adult, more talking about Anakin. But so Jar Jar's for kids. I think you can do kids better. I don't think you have to, I don't think things for kids have to be stupid. I think the level of Jar Jar Binks is like 3-year-olds. I think it's so, so infantile. There's no wit. There's no charm. It's just stupid for stupid's sake because, you know, George wrote everything himself. There were no collaborators. And, you know, he's not great at everything. That's Jar Jar. And, you know, he's going to be annoying in every possible scene. He's brought along in certain sequences of the film where he does not belong simply for comedic effect. So, you know, there you have it. Jar Jar is what Jar Jar is. But then, you know, from annoying to the beautiful, because then we're taken to the Gungan city. Our Jedi go underwater and they swim into this beautifully lit sort of glass bowl city, as it were. It's a wonderful moment where they kind of swim down and they walk through this little scrim, kind of a force field between the water and the interior of the city. And it's a beautiful moment. There's a nice John Williams, you know, cue here, a lot of, you know, ethereal voices. When we get to meet the Gungans, we realize that it's Ewoks, right? The Gungans are really the Ewoks. And this film is picking up where Return of the Jedi left off. I think tonally, Return of the Jedi anticipates the prequel trilogies a lot. These are your Ewoks. These are your Kenner toy line right here. You know, make them fuzzy, make them plastic, whatever you want. It's the Gungans. So then the leader of the Gungans, Boss Nass, sounds like, you know, a retarded warthog. Misa no like this, Misa no like that. You know, the weird thing about the Gungans, which I don't like, is first of all, they have this incredibly engineered war machine, which I'll get to later, and this beautifully engineered city, and they're a bunch of clowns. Like, they're portrayed as being not so smart. You know, clever Qui-Gon gets to use his Jedi mind trick on Boss Nass, you know, to give them a ship and send them on their way. And I just feel like it's a beautiful, beautiful place, and it's populated by, you know, more kids' toys, basically. So then we have our first little adventure. Of course, the two Jedi take Jar Jar because they say they need a guide through the planet core, meaning, you know, I don't think Jar Jar Binks knows the way to the bathroom, much less to the planet core. But Jar Jar is in the movie as comic relief, and that's it. They take a ship called a Bongo, which is kind of a cool-looking ship. And it's more kid stuff. There are two instances where one instance where a huge fish grasps the, you know, grabs hold of the ship, and then another bigger fish eats it, and then they're about to be eaten by one fish, and another fish eats that one. You never feel like, you know, our heroes are in much danger. It's all very breezy and fun. No one's sweating about it. It is what it is. And then we cut to the advance of the droid army now on Naboo City. Again, beautiful John Williams score. We're getting more shots of the city. Very beautiful. We see that the Queen Amidala is captured, or so we think. And as they're marching her through the city, the Jedi intervene and we get a little bit of a firefight, you know, and our Jedi rescue her. Some nice lightsaber fighting. Sometimes the Jedi look a little too casual. It's a little too dancey in terms of when the sabers hit things. But, you know, it's lightsaber fighting, you know, I love it. I can't get enough. So they wind up leaving Naboo in this beautiful transport ship, which this beautiful silver ship, which I think was a design that was stolen almost exactly from an old U.S. spy plane called the SR-71 Blackbird. Very much reminded me of the Blackbird with a few odds and ends changed around. It's bigger, given a bridge, you know, and painted silver. But it's beautiful. There's a similar ship in the beginning of Attack of the Clones, which looks like kind of an old bomber. There's a visual style to the Naboo sort of royal ships, which I think is really beautiful. So we have this brief moment where they have to run the blockade. There's about 4 or 5 different astromech droids, and they all go out on the top of the ship. They're magnetically stuck to it as the ship's in battle. And R2's the only one left, brings the shields back online, and they run the blockade, and they escape, and they go to hyperspace. There's a brief moment when Gunray has to report to Sidious that they lost the princess. And Sidious says, I will be sending my apprentice Darth Maul. He will find your lost ship. And walking into the hologram field behind Sidious, we see Maul for the first time. Just creepy looking dude. I think Maul is like a triumph of character design. Really scary looking guy. Then we have this wonderful little moment where we're introduced to R2-D2, I guess for the first time in the franchise. It's commended by the Queen. What's its designation? R2-D2, my Queen, you know. So a little bit of a name check there for R2. Then, you know, we start getting a little bit of Queen Amidala's performance. You know, there's this the decoy thing where at this point in the film, Natalie Portman plays Padme, purportedly a handmaiden of the Queen. And I have to say that Portman's performance in this entire trilogy of films is just like a, you know, really abysmally boring and wooden and dull. She is terrible. She really delivers her lines with a flat deadness that she could, my God, this is one of the most beloved franchises in film history. Can you give it a little effort? You know, like, oh, she's just dreadful in it. The Queen is just this dead, monotone nothing. Not that there's much on the page, but Natalie Portman does not give it one erg of personality. Compared to Carrie Fisher for a version of the complete opposite. Then we are back on Tatooine. They need to go into the city. Their hyperdrive is damaged, so they need to buy a new one. So you have Qui-Gon going in, for some reason needing to take Jar Jar Binks with him. Like you know, Qui-Gon and Jar Jar are going, and no one says anything about why Jar Jar would go with Qui-Gon to get a hyperdrive generator in Tatooine. And yet, you know, he's not too keen on Padme's handmaiden coming with him. It's like, you know, they find Watto's shop and we meet Watto, the Tidarian, I believe he is, the flying Tidarian. Very cool. Again, another CGI character. Much cooler than Jar Jar. I take Watto over Jar Jar any day. Yeah, it's like, bring Watto, you know, let Jar Jar run the junk shop and they should have taken Watto with them. I'm sure the whole world knows about this, but when they go out back to the junkyard to look for the hyperdrive, just when they emerge out to the back of the shop, you can see the half-buried remains of one of the pods in 2001. Open the pod bay door, Hal, one of the pods back there. So a little little visual Easter egg if you're looking. There's a couple more in this film later on. Okay, so Jar Jar basically is annoying in most of the scene. And then here we meet young Jake Lloyd, who is a terrible actor. You know, I'm sure he's a really nice kid, but he's a really, really bad child actor. His lines are said much like Portman's. When him and Portman are on the screen having dialogue, it's like attack of the tone-deaf actors. It's the most hysterical thing I've ever seen. Like, it's just two actors, two terrible actors mouthing terrible dialogue. Like, you've never seen the like. One decently written thing here is that Republic credits are not good on Tatooine since it's sort of the Outer Rim territories, and Jedi mind tricks don't work on Watto, so they have to figure out a way to come up with cash to buy the hyperdrive for the ship. They leave with not having a solution. They bump into, well, Jar Jar bumps into Sebulba, who will be the antagonist soon to come. He is a Dug, which is some sort of alien creature, and because of an arriving sandstorm, Anakin shows them to where he lives with his mom. Their residence, Shmi Skywalker. We are told that he and Shmi are slaves. Slavery exists on Tatooine. We see a 3PO. We meet 3PO unplated, as it were. He's just still being built by Anakin. So really cool. We hear Anthony Daniels, and he's in a bunch of scenes on Tatooine, which is great. And when 3PO and R2-D2 meet, you know, as bad as he writes this stuff, there's so much goodwill towards these characters because of the original trilogy that when they meet for the first time, it's a little bit of a thrill, I gotta say. I got a little excited. Then we do a quick cut to Coruscant to do a little Darth Maul, Darth Sidious, bad guys plotting. Then we, on Tatooine, we're at the Skywalker residence, right? And we have Liam Neeson and Pernilla August, who is, I believe, a Swedish actress who was in, strangely enough, Ingmar Bergman's Fanny and Alexander. To me, it's like Neeson and August are like the two adults, the two parents in like a child's play, because Portman's terrible, Jake Lloyd is terrible, Jar Jar is stupid. So it's like these three idiots, and I feel like these two actors are there like, hey, so what are you doing later? Want to get some coffee and hang out? You know, it's such a strange thing. Whenever they have dialogue together, too, later on, I think Qui-Gon says, you know, you're going to be okay. I'm like, oh my God, two adults talking to each other. it's so weird, you know, like it's not stupid. It's just so odd. They're just these two. I feel like they probably went off later at the craft table and were like, can you believe we're doing this kind of thing? I can't believe it. But boy, George pays really well. So let's just smile and keep it going, you know, just bizarre. So then George adds a little bit of Campbell myth cycle stuff. And so now he adds this whole virgin birth that Anakin was perhaps conceived by, wait for it, the midichlorians, right? So now we're given two huge new things in the Star Wars universe. Virgin births, which comes out of nowhere. We're introduced to the concept of midichlorians. Now, this was another very divisive thing in the Star Wars universe because both sides of the story, midichlorians for George allows him to, they're a reason why Anakin's special. So I feel like he's sitting there writing this. How are the Jedi going to know that Anakin is a special life form? You know, if he's just some young kid who's got an affinity for the Force, so what? You know, like there's a half a dozen of them probably on any given, you know, sector of space of Force-sensitive kids. And there'd be no special notice taken. But I feel like George was kind of stuck here. And he was like, well, what would a chosen one look like? He had to come up with something like the midichlorians and then he gets tested for them. Now, you know, Qui-Gon and them can see like he has the highest midichlorian concentration in his cells of any life form. All of a sudden, now Anakin's a very special kid. And then you throw in, well, there is a prophecy of the Chosen One. So you get the virgin birth, the Chosen One, and the midichlorians to clue them in that this might be the Chosen One. Otherwise, there's no other way unless you're going to do, like, you know, magic of, like, there's a halo around him or something. Like, how else are you going to have the two Jedi impressed enough with the kid? Because he's not displaying any skills. He's a good pod racer, but he's not displaying, like, these miraculous skills where they're, like, only a chosen one could do this or that. So I feel like George was kind of screwed in that he had to come up with something like that. I don't mind it so much. The negative side of it is that midichlorians now make force sensitives. It's a genetic thing. So meaning not everyone can connect to the Force. You have to be born with like these high levels of midichlorians. And it makes it kind of an elitist thing to be a Force user now. I did a little bit of reading about that. And, you know, the commentary is sort of that on Wikipedia too. It states that you can have a somewhat lower midichlorian count than a Jedi next to you and be a better Force user or connect to the Force in a more intense way, right? Because Yoda definitely can, you know, outfight and outforce use Anakin pretty much at any stage in his career, and Yoda has lower midichlorian count than Anakin does. So there is kind of an escape clause where this doesn't, but at the same time, not everyone can connect to the Force. It is everywhere in the world, you know, and everywhere in the universe, and you can't not be part of the Force, but not everyone can be a Force user. So there's two variables here, high midichlorians and low midichlorians, a high Force sensitive and low Force sensitive, and they're mutually exclusive. So you can have someone with a massive midichlorian count who can barely touch the Force, and you can have someone with a low midichlorian count who's like an amazing Force user. So I think. It's kind of what I've been reading. So there's a little bit of a mitigating factor here in that it's not like midichlorians are like you're guaranteed to be and it's going to be passed down through generations and only certain families will control the Force and all that crap. Anyway, it's a weird thing. I feel like if the film would have been a deep, really incredibly well-told and well-acted, well-scripted thing, no one would have given a shit about the midichlorians. But the fact that it's such a bad movie on so many levels, well, I'll get to that later on. I won't get to that now. So then we have a quick cut of Darth Maul landing on Tatooine. He has found our heroes, and he sends these seeker droids out to look for them, which kind of reminded me of like the repulsor remote that Luke was practicing to in Star Wars, and they have these antennas, and you know John Williams has come up with this kind of drum-heavy, evil guy soundtrack cue for Darth Maul, which I really like, very cool. And so the centerpiece of this is the pod race, and I feel like the two high points of this film are the lightsaber duel at the end of the movie and the pod race. This pod race is an amazing thing. I mean, this is George is at home here. He used to drag racing cars when he was a teenager. He did American Graffiti, which was a lot about drag racing. This is George like in his element, and it's terrific and very thrilling. There's more real drama in the pod race, I think, than in any human interaction anywhere in the film. And there's a lot of fun stuff to look at. There's Jabba the Hutt and his wife, Mrs. Hutt, standing behind them. The two announcers that are part of one body, which are a lot of fun. That's gotta hurt. You know, a lot of funny lines. The pods are all great. They're all different. And they look very beat up and rough, like a lot of stuff on Tatooine does. George is keeping to that junkyard Tatooine aesthetic. So they look really cool. We immediately set up a bit of a story of Sebulba walks over to gloat to Annie, and he does something to his pod, which, you know, we'll put him in jeopardy later. We do a visual setup as well, where we see in Anakin's pod that when things aren't so great, we're getting red lights and flashing things. And when things are fine, everything's green, which I think is great because you can now do visual drama by just cutting to the control panel to find out what's going on. Very, very subtle, but very clever. When they're starting up these pods, you get this heat haze that makes it kind of, it affects the air. It makes it hard to see them sometimes, which is another really beautiful detail. Young Warwick Davis, who was the star of Willow, is in this briefly. You see him in a bunch of scenes. When the actual race starts, Anakin is left at the starting line because his pod conks out. So we already begin with him behind, which is great tension. And it's just cut really well. You just, you know, since there's three laps, you get to know the different landforms and the different things that they have to go through. So you're anticipating second and third time, like when they go through stuff, which is terrific. We're visually checking the sand people. They're firing pot shots at the pod racers as they go by. The sound design is just incredible. The engines are kind of like, these amazing sound design creations for these pods are really, again, this is where, you know, we come back to the genius of the original trilogy. I felt was all over the pod race, you know, beautiful sound design, just interesting that they're the pods themselves. And the tension is all the way down to the wire when Sebulba's, you know, and Anakin's pod are stuck together. The wonderful tension when Annie's pod loses power because of what Sebulba did. You know, so these wonderful things are seeded throughout the race in perfectly paced ways. And it's just a terrific, thrilling part of the movie. I really, really like it. Then we have the parting of Anakin and his mother, which is, you know, the beginnings of the, you know, his character's tragic flaw. The writing is just so bad. It's so, so bad. Even Pernell August looks like, she's like, when do I get out of this damn gig? This is the most embarrassing dialogue I've ever had to speak in my life. It's terrible. I don't buy it for a minute. I don't buy her. I don't buy him. I don't buy any of it. It's like high school level drama. There's a brief skirmish now when Darth Maul finds the ship. There's a brief skirmish between Qui-Gon and Maul, which is great. It's flurry of cuts, and I think it's purposeful. You're not supposed to see too much here, but just get the sense that this is a badass dude who can stand toe-to-toe with a Jedi. There's this wonderful parting shot of Darth Maul as the ship takes off. He just stands there looking up, and he kind of deactivates one part of his saber. You know, you're also being teased here because in this shot, Maul is using his only one blade of his twin-bladed saber. When he does the twin-bladed later to take on two opponents, it's wonderfully exciting because, you know, you just expect that he's just going to have a single saber. So let me get to Coruscant, this beautiful center planet of the Republic. Coruscant really comes from two places. First of all, the name is the one thing from the expanded universe that made it into the canon. Coruscant was Timothy Zahn's name for the center of the Republic. Lucas took a shine to the name and used it. So way to go, Tim Zahn, getting something over the transom. Coruscant is basically the Star Wars version of the planet Trantor, which if folks have read Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, Trantor was famous for being an entire planet, which is one big city. There's not a piece of the planet that's open to the, you know, to the naked air. This is a direct pull from Trantor, so, and a good pull nonetheless. So it's a beautiful, beautiful city. It's really a triumph of special effects. I immediately noticed the traffic patterns and the shadows from the ships. So when the Naboo cruiser lands and they're standing on this platform, we're getting the dapplings of shadows passing over them from the vehicles that are in the air above them on either side. Really, really amazing. Then we meet Chancellor Valorum, who's played by the incredibly wonderful actor Terrence Stamp, who's given zero to do here, and Chancellor Palpatine, played by the wonderful Ian McGregor. Stamp is basically a mannequin. He's got very few lines. He delivers them in the most wooden, stiff voice I don't think a human being can do. He's just completely unmemorable. You could have gotten anyone for that role. McDermott is fantastic, though. He's like, you know, again, chaperoning the terrible actors or the characters who have horrible lines. He's just wonderful. Somehow he can make this all work, him and Neeson. It's amazing. You also have Annie goes to visit Amidala before she goes to the Senate. And boy, she's wearing a gown here that is just stunning. Again, she's made up as like Japanese, you know, kind of kabuki. Her face is painted and she's got this incredible elaborate gown. Again, the detail here. Get a good Blu-ray copy of Phantom Menace and really the details and her costumes. Just beautiful, really beautiful. So then, you know, very exciting moment, right? We're in the Jedi Council, which is atop this beautiful Jedi temple. And we meet Yoda, Mace Windu, played by Samuel L. Jackson. The Senate Chamber is the next thing we see, which is another triumph of production design. This beautiful dome, the inside, each world has its own little pod, and they detach from the side of the chamber when they have the floor. It's beautiful. You know, and we get more of the overarching plot here. We can see that Palpatine is kind of nudging Amidala to call for a vote of no confidence and so on and so forth. We get some Easter eggs here. We see the Wookiees in one of these pods, and we also see Steven Spielberg's E.T. race in another of the pods. You got to look fast. They come and go really quickly. Anakin's tested briefly in the Jedi Temple by reading, I think, someone's mind and telling them what they're looking at. But in that temple, boy, you know, the backdrop is just stunning because it's open to, it's all glass, you know. So you're in this massive tower way high up in the Jedi Temple. Outside is just Coruscant surrounding them, and it's beautiful, really, really beautiful. The vote of no confidence is called. Amidala decides to go back to Naboo. Palpatine is worried that she's going to sign a treaty. We still don't know what the hell, what treaty is it? What do they want from her? What do they want her to do? We're not told that. So it undercuts her decision to go back there. We don't even know why they're slaughtering her race, what the treaty is about. To me, it undercuts it, makes it a very lightweight story that you can't get invested in because truly, you know, the roots of the whole story are in quicksand. So there's a moment. Now we get back. We're back on Naboo. There's a kind of a flat but okay scene between Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, because back at the Jedi Temple, Qui-Gon had told the Jedi Council that Obi-Wan was ready to take the Jedi trials and that he was no longer needed to be an apprentice because Qui-Gon wanted to take on Anakin as his apprentice. So they have this nice moment where it's like, you've been a very loyal apprentice and I foresee you'll be a great Jedi Knight and all that. So it's kind of like a passing of the torch, like Qui-Gon's kind of letting go of Anakin at this point, letting go of Obi-Wan at this point. So very cool. So then there's this plot where Amidala has to go find the Gungans. They're not in the city. They're in some, you know, gathering place where they go when they're under threat. Kind of looks like Angkor Wat in Cambodia. You know, a lot of those types of crowns on the ground, you know. We get the whole decoy thing finally is revealed when the decoy playing Amidala is not getting results. So Amidala comes out of hiding saying, that's my decoy. This is who I really am. Portman's speech is very flat and boring and dull as she is. And, you know, this wonderful race of Gungans who built that incredible city and have these incredible creatures and this incredible war tech, which we'll come to see. Their response is, Misa no thinking yous are greater than the Gungans. Misa like this. It's just the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. And then they make Jar Jar Binks general of the army because George Lucas hates all of us, basically. We get this attack plan. And again, there's not a lot of real drama here. She's like, you know, the whole idea is that we got to get to the Viceroy. He's the main thing. If we capture the Viceroy. And I'm thinking to myself, if they capture the Viceroy, what? What is going to happen? Okay, so you're going to stop them from invading, but what's the story here? You know, like, why? Anyway, you can tell already how I feel about it. We have the three parts. We have, I believe there's four parts. So we have the Gungans versus the droid army. We have the space battle. We have the capture the Viceroy mission by the Queen and her sort of retinue. And then we have this marvelous duel between Darth Maul, Qui-Gon, and Obi-Wan. So I'll briefly do each part. The Gungan droid battle is actually pretty cool, other than Jar Jar's hijinks. Like, they come out of the swamp with this wonderful aborigine, like, horn plays. And they start up this shield, which is beautiful. Very, very striking looking. And it's very epic. George really has a sense of epic scale here when he's filming this battle. Like, it's a massive battle. It's too bad this is, like, very little drama behind it. Or none of us really give a shit about what happens in this battle. But it's given quite a decent scope by George. He shot it really well. And then when the droid army unfolds itself, these wonderful tanks come over the hills and they start shooting and the laser blasts impact on the shield. And it looks beautiful, man. Like, the CGI is flawless here. And then since it's not working, the army has to deploy and activate the droid foot soldiers, which is just beautifully done. Incredibly well thought out, you know, how the ships open up and how they get the droids, the soldiers down to the ground. Just amazing. And then, you know, the Gungans pull out this other cool tech. They've got these energy shields, and they've got these, like, these sort of electric marbles, which is kind of what they look like, small ones and large ones, that if they impact the droids, short them out. And it's like, this is the race that, you know, they talk like retarded children that has these beautiful cities and this incredible tech. Like, it doesn't make any sense, but the tech is cool. And then, but so much of it is marred by Jar Jar, you know, and his antics. We're supposed to have this battle. You don't see any Gungans really die. It's all Ewoks again. You don't really give a shit. It doesn't matter. Jar Jar's having a good time swinging on a tank. He's killing droids because he's trying to escape the clutches of a droid cut in half. And every time he jumps, the laser gun miraculously hits a droid. Like, it's the dumbest stuff you've ever seen. Then you have the battle in space, which is equally as absurd. 10-year-old Anakin is taking off by mistake. R2's in the fighter. They're in this Naboo fighter. And again, once you're up there, it's very much like Return of the Jedi. There's just 1,000 ships. The quality is much better, actually. The ships look really cool, but there's no dramatic action. I don't really know anyone up there but Anakin, and he's a kid. So I don't really have any sympathy for the pilots. I don't really care if they get killed or not. It's all too big and too fast moving for me. You're continually cutting to little Jake Lloyd up there like he's playing a video game. He's having a blast. He's having fun. He's spinning. Let's try spinning. Okay, you know. So there's no stakes here at all. It's the same with the battle on the planet as here. There's no stakes. It's just a lot of fun. It's, you know, it's basically, you know, McDonald's Happy Meals in action. And it's very Return of the Jedi-like, right? He flies inside the structure to destroy it. So he destroys the control ship, which saves the Gungans on the planet. And basically, you know, the droid army is now defunct. While this is going on, we have the, you know, get to the Viceroy mission by Amidala and her crew. Basically, several firefights and several long hallways. There's kind of a Batman sequence where they have these grappling hooks on their guns. You know, they grapple up the side of the palace to get to another level. Ha, who cares? They're seemingly captured, and yet then her decoy shows up, distracting them, and they find all these hidden weapons. It doesn't matter. And then Portman's, now we shall discuss a new treaty. It's all boring. None of it, you know, there's no real drama in any of it. And Natalie Portman, too, she's very young. She's running around like she's playing outside. She's playing war with her friends, you know. None of it matters. I mean, the first Star Wars film, The Attack on the Death Star, it mattered, man. It was real. People died. It was bloody at times. Like, this is a joke. You know, I don't know what this is about. In complete contrast, the duel between Maul, Qui-Gon, and Obi-Wan is, in my mind, the greatest duel in the entire Star Wars canon. Obviously, Force Awakens hasn't come yet, and I expect great things from Abrams, no doubt. This duel is unbelievable. It's unbelievable. It belongs in another movie, frankly. You know, we start with Darth Maul's unveiling, right? He's a Zabrak, the race that he's in, and he's got hornrows, which is just the coolest thing. I mean, he looks like a devil, but it's a really great character design. He just looks nasty. He's got these red eyes out of nowhere, like out of this toy plaything that George has constructed. All of a sudden, we've got a real nasty looking character here. He's very elemental. He doesn't speak. This is just a dude who's sent to kill. He doesn't want to turn anyone to the dark side. He doesn't want to prove any point or recruit separatists. He's just a killer. He's just a killer. And it makes him very elemental and very scary. I have another podcast where I just do the Star Wars lightsaber duels from all the films. So I won't go blow by blow here, but I'll just do some talking points on the duel. Number one, there's no talking at all in the duel. There's no learners, no circles, no lectures, no bullshit, no Dooku you're going to pay, nothing. Three pros throwing down. That's what this is about. And it's awesome. Another point, we see tactics. We see actual fight tactics. How do two fighters take on one fighter? How does one fighter protect themselves against two fighters, right? And we see often Maul trying to stay from being enveloped on both sides from the two Jedi, who continuously try to envelop him on both sides because that's a weakness of one fighter, right? You get surrounded. You can't fight two guys at the same time. So Maul is continuously trying to keep them in front of him and not surround. And you can see that. And there's one moment where Obi-Wan goes in for a strike, but it's a fake. And it's actually Qui-Gon going in for the strike. And I thought, holy shit, tactics, you know? It's really great. Ray Park is astounding. The athleticism that he shows and the initial flip. You know, there's an initial flip where he kind of does a flip in the air and then force grabs a piece of debris and then hits the door opener behind him. You're like, what? Brilliant. The Jedi look rough and ready, man. They look tough. They look like this is their job, you know? Like, there's one point in this fight where, you know, Qui-Gon elbows Darth Maul to the face, so he's getting his hands dirty a little bit. It's not so pretty, right? There's a wonderful sequence where Qui-Gon is actually winning the duel. Obi-Wan's been knocked down. Obi-Wan gets taken out of three fights in the prequel trilogy. He gets taken out of this fight to start. When Anakin's fighting Dooku, he gets taken out. And at the end, when Anakin's fighting Dooku again, he gets taken out. I hate that. He gets brushed aside so they can, you know, so they can do other things. But he falls behind. And Qui-Gon, the sequence where he pushes Maul back through those doors, those force doors, energy doors, is really thrilling. And, you know, strangely enough, I feel like the pause in the battle actually saves Maul, because I feel like Qui-Gon was just pressing the attack, and you can see it. And Qui-Gon, he just looks so badass when he's fighting Maul. As badass as Maul is, when Qui-Gon's pushing him back, man, you're like, man, this dude is bad, you know? The energy doors near the end of the duel, I think, were a genius idea. They stole it from Bruce Lee, Enter the Dragon. If you go see that film, there's a scene where Bruce Lee gets caught between a couple of doors and he immediately sits down and starts to meditate between battles. Stolen, but brilliantly stolen, because it creates drama in the fight. We have to wait to see what's going to happen next. And Maul gets cut off from Qui-Gon. Qui-Gon gets cut off from Anakin. And then, you know, when the doors open and then close again, it's Maul and Qui-Gon, and then Obi-Wan's cut off. If I said Anakin just before, pardon me. So it creates drama. They film the whole thing very wide, not a lot of cuts. There's a lot of choreography in the frame and very few cuts, which makes it that much more exciting to watch. The Obi-Wan Darth Maul face-off after Qui-Gon gets killed, or gets stabbed, I should say, is incredible. The sheer amount of strikes and moves between the two. And again, it's shot wide and it's got emotion and power to it. The end of the duel completely when Obi-Wan cuts Maul in two is just very exciting and thrilling. Really good end. So really, really enjoy that. And, you know, then you have the end of that moment where Qui-Gon is like on his deathbed. He's still like obsessed with the boy. You got to train the boy. He's the chosen one. He's the boy. And a pet peeve here is that, you know, we don't get much character development from Qui-Gon. Why is it so important that the chosen one, first of all, balance to the force. What's unbalanced about the force? No one can tell from the movie that the force is unbalanced, number one. Number two, why does Qui-Gon have such a hard-on about balancing the force and finding the chosen one? No reason is given for us in the film. It's another one of these things where they're just like, oh, he's the chosen one. It's like, so what? Who cares? You know, it's like right now the Republic is in control. It's a benign democracy, you know, not in the best shape, but what do you need a chosen one for? Everything's fine, you know, mostly. The bad guys haven't really taken over yet, so it makes no sense. And I think, again, it's another thing where a little character development, a little bit more spent about why is the chosen one so important? How is the force out of balance? Can't see it. Don't understand it. And then we get a very quick ending where, you know, we have the funeral of Qui-Gon and a lot of talking in between, setting up the next film. And then we get the triumphant, you know, peaceful celebrations, so on and so forth. And then we're out. So a brief summary. To me, again, this is Return of the Jedi writ large. You know, Jedi really set up the template of a very childlike films that George would do, at least for the first two prequels. The third one, I think he tried to do a little better. It's for, you know, most of this movie is for very, very young children. So here's why this movie is watchable for me. And here's why. What it is, the movie moves because the technology and the action and the production design, not because of story, character, and dialogue. The story, the character, and dialogue are non-existent for me in this movie. They're hollow shells that do not compel me through the film. However, I start the film. Two Jedi are in action in the, you know, the golden age of Jedi. Holy cow. Gungan City, amazing. We're back on Tatooine. Holy cow. The pod race, amazing. Coruscant, amazing. The Jedi Temple, holy cow. The Senate Chamber, amazing. Then the battle in Naboo, which keeps flipping around, you know, like whether or not it's dramatic or not. The sheer novelty of the changes that George just continues to put new things in front of the camera, one after the other. And the minute I'm bored with his idiotic dialogue, some new visual thing is wowing me on the screen. So I can watch this film, and I can watch it for the, you know, the wonderful pod race and the incredible duel. And I can lament, you know, at how terrible the rest of it is. But for whatever reason, I can put it on, and I'm visually like, ah, Naboo's beautiful. Hey, look, it's the pod race. And just purely visually, it's a delight in that way. But it's a terrible, terrible film in terms of acting, dialogue, character, and story. Liam Neeson and Ian McDiarmid are heroic to me. They're the real heroes of this film because they're able to imbue George's absurd dialogue with some gravitas, which is just stunning to me. Jake Lloyd and Natalie Portman are just abysmally bad and given to terrible dialogue. And Samuel Jackson, poor Ewan McGregor, you know, also a very likable actor, very likable character, but the Obi-Wan dialogue for the most part, ugh, it's so stiff, you know. Seeing the Jedi Order in full bloom, really wonderful. The young saber fighters, love that stuff. And John Williams' score is incredible. I feel like Williams really outdid himself with this one. There are wonderfully memorable themes in this for different things that you're seeing in the movie. They're exciting, incredibly well recorded. It's just wonderful. Like, Williams is like completely on point here. So I've got a bunch of trivia for episode one. Tupac Shakur, a Star Wars fan since his childhood, expressed interest in reading for a role, even lobbying mutual friends of his and Lucas's to get them in touch with each other to set up a meeting. But his tragic murder in September 1996 prevented any such meeting from taking place. It has been speculated that he was up for the part of Mace, but the character name was not publicly known before filming started, and it was not specifically written for an African-American until Jackson was cast. In early concept art, Windu was drawn as an alien, and also with the likeness of concept designer Doug Chang. Jake Lloyd has said that he retired from acting because of the trauma he experienced after playing Anakin Skywalker. According to Lloyd, other children constantly teased him about the role. For example, they'd make lightsaber sounds whenever he walked by. Lloyd also said that the situation was made worse because, in his opinion, the film did not meet the fans' expectations. Despite this, Lloyd has reprised the role of Anakin in several video games and has appeared at Star Wars conventions and events. There's only one shot in the film to which no visual effects were added at all, the shot of the dioxys gas pouring out of the vent in the Trade Federation ship meeting room. Liam Neeson convinced George Lucas to keep a scene where Qui-Gon puts his hand on Shmi Skywalker's shoulder. Lucas felt this might be out of character for the monk-like Jedi, but Neeson thought there should be an emotional connection between the characters. In an interview with Premiere Magazine, Neeson defended his actions, saying, quote, "It may be Star Wars, but we've got to have something in there for the adults," end quote. Benicio del Toro was originally set to play Darth Maul, but del Toro left the film after Lucas took most of Maul's lines out. At the time of the film's release, the producers ran a disinformation campaign to suggest that Natalie Portman played both Padme and the Queen at all times. In fact, they are not always the same person for many sections of the film, notably those where the Queen is wearing the black outfit with the huge feather headdress. She's actually a decoy played by Keira Knightley. The real Queen Portman is actually disguised as a handmaiden. Various conflicting public statements make it extremely difficult to figure out who is who. Whole websites are devoted to figuring out which actress is playing which handmaiden or the Queen at any given point. One of the first casting rumors for the alleged Star Wars prequel came from a science fiction magazine called Star Blazer. In their summer 85 issue, they published that Sybil Danning was to possibly portray the sexy witch that seduces Anakin Skywalker to the dark side. In 2012, Sybil Danning confirmed on her Facebook page that the rumor was indeed true and that many discussions took place at that time. Denzel Washington, Tom Hanks, Morgan Freeman, and Kurt Russell were considered for the part of Qui-Gon Jinn. Ewan McGregor, who plays Obi-Wan Kenobi, is the nephew of Dennis Lawson, who played Wedge Antilles in Star Wars Episode 4, 5, and 6. Darth Maul's double-bladed lightsaber design was borrowed from the 1996 comic book series Tales of the Jedi, The Sith War. Special effects teams creating the pod race studied NASCAR crash footage extensively to assure accuracy in the crashes. Tests were conducted to see if Yoda could be realized digitally, but it was determined that the technology was not up to scratch. A CG model of Yoda was nevertheless created, but only used in one shot, a long shot, incidentally, during the scene on Naboo, near the end where Obi-Wan and Yoda discuss Anakin's future. George Lucas's very first draft of Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, began, quote, "This is the story of Mace Windu, a revered Jedi Bendu of Opuchi, who was related to Usbi C.J. Thape, a Padawan learner of the famed Jedi," end quote. Both the character of Mace Windu and the concept of Padawan learners made their first appearance in this film. There's an Easter egg that I didn't know about. The Starship Enterprise from Star Trek The Next Generation, so the Enterprise D, can be seen briefly amongst the traffic flying around Coruscant. According to Ahmed Best in a Rolling Stone article, Michael Jackson campaigned for the role of Jar Jar Binks, but Lucas decided against casting him because his star status would compromise the film. At one point, Lucas took Best and Natalie Portman backstage at a concert and introduced Best to Jackson to gain the singer's approval. And this is interesting. Lucas didn't initially want to do all the writing himself. So he approached Lawrence Kasdan to write the scripts, possibly for all three films. And Kasdan turned it down, saying that these are now George's films and he should do it himself. He then approached playwright David Hare to write the screenplay and, what George says, to even co-direct the film, which is amazing. Lucas confessed that he had reservations about working with the actors and hoped that he could focus on the action and the effects while Hare focused on the action. Hare declined. But I thought that was interesting that, you know, at one point, Lucas does recognize his limitations, but nobody wants to go work in his world. You know, it's like working in someone else's universe. So one last bit, Roman Coppola played a Naboo guard and his sister Sofia Coppola played a handmaiden of the Queen's. They both made their film debuts in The Godfather in 1972, on which George Lucas was an assistant editor. Did not know that. So that's it for the trivia. I hope you enjoyed my take on episode one. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com. Or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you can search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.